This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It did happen. It was not a dream. Or if it was, even now, 3 days after the fact, the Red Sox and their fans, including the ones behind home plate in Yankee Stadium on Wednesday night, are still asleep.
Yes! There it is. There it is right there! That's the one!
After losing three, Boston beat New York in four straight games, culminating in Wednesday night's 10-3 win, to capture the American League Championship Series and the opportunity to host Game 1 of the World Series this evening. Eddie Gutierrez was among the Yankee fans who couldn't quite believe what was happening, though it had transpired right before his eyes.
Oh, it's unfortunate. I never thought I'd see the day when I watched the Red Sox fans celebrate in our house, you know? So it's an ill feeling. It's a bitter feeling. But I guess we got to hope for next year.
The response of that Yankees fan may well have been representative of Yankees fans. On the field after the game, Red Sox general manager Theo Epstein spoke for another constituency.
This one's for all the teams, Red Sox teams that couldn't quite beat the Yankees. You know, 49, Ted Williams, Bobby Doerr, Donnie Pesky, Dominic DiMaggio. For those guys, 78, last year's team, we got it done. And we're going together to the World Series, going to get that done now.
In the context of payback, at least one Boston fan, a fellow named Terry, who'd made the trip south to the ballpark in the Bronx for the seventh game, remembered an occasion Mr. Epstein had omitted, perhaps because it had involved the other team from New York, the Mets.
This is great. I was there last year in Game 7. I was there in 86 for the Buckner game. It's finally time.
Back on the field, the Red Sox players were being asked to talk about what beating the Yankees and going to the World Series meant to them, a task that all but overmatched relief pitcher Keith Falk.
I mean, it's the best thing ever. I mean, you know, one of the greatest feelings I've ever had in my life. I can't express it. Just can't express it.
Boston outfielder Gabe Kapler was a little more successful in marshaling his thoughts. To explain his team's success, he fell back on the formula the Sox have been espousing since spring training.
We're family here. We care about each other. We pull for each other. And I think that there's a lot of heartfelt, you know, joy going on right now. Not just because we won, but because we pulled together and we did something that nobody expected us to do.
True enough, at least after the Yankees won the first three games of the ALCS, that would be because no team had ever crawled out of such a hole before. Tonight in Fenway Park, the Sox and their fans will begin to find out if the Cardinals have read the script that says it's Boston's year. Joining me now is our baseball analyst Tim Kirkchin of ESPN and ESPN.com. And Tim, I can't help myself. I have to ask it, are the Yankees still the Yankees?
You know what, Bill? They're not the Yankees anymore because one ghost has been exorcised, and that is the ghost of the Red Sox, and that's done with now. That's a fact. And I have never, obviously no one's ever seen a collapse quite like that. And for it to happen against the Red Sox, for it to happen after everything that happened last year, everything that happened this season, after Game 3 in which the Yankees won 19-8, to be swept like that, it is fair to now say the Yankees are no longer the Yankees. That's it.
Now, it's interesting the way you characterized this turn of events. Was this, in fact, the greatest collapse in baseball history or the greatest comeback in baseball history?
Bill, there's no other way around it. It is both, okay? By definition, it is both, okay? Given that no baseball team had ever come back from 3-0 to even force a seventh game, and here the Red Sox came back and won a seventh game. And also understand that in the Joe Torre era, his teams have never been up 2-0 in 2-0 in a series and allowed it to even go to a sixth game. This time they were up 3-0 and they lost in the seventh game. So there's no question this is the greatest collapse of all time, but I prefer to call it the greatest comeback of all time because ultimately what the Red Sox did, I think, was more that the Red Sox were great than the Yankees were terrible. However, the Yankees were not good during those final four games.
St. Louis won 105 games during the regular season behind very impressive slugging. Will the Cardinals be favored in the World Series because of their murderer's row, to steal a term from Yankee history, or is their pitching staff too weak to sufficiently subdue Boston sluggers?
Well, I think the Cardinals are going to be favored, perhaps, but only slightly. And I think just as many people will pick the Red Sox. And I know this. This is the highest scoring team in the National League against the highest scoring team in the American League. And you better pack a lunch, Bill, because we're going to be there for a while. Because as good as some of the pitchers are on these teams, clearly they're not going to be enough, at least in my mind, to stop either one of these teams from scoring. And I think it's going to be a very high-scoring World Series. It'll be a very exciting and entertaining World Series. But I just don't see enough pitching on either team to hold down two tremendous offensive clubs.
Well, particularly with both of the series, championship series going to seven games and extra inning games in the American League contests, my gosh, they must be exhausted all the way through.
Well, they are. And that was the most amazing thing to me about the Yankee-Red Sox series, is how the Red Sox bullpen held it together when they were all exhausted, when they had starting pitchers pitching in relief, mm-hmm. Game 3 starters, Game 4 starters volunteering to pitch earlier in the series. It was ridiculous. But yes, I think both staffs are fairly gassed at this point. And it's October, they're all gassed. And again, that's another reason why I think we're going to see a couple of 9-8 games in this series.
As long as we don't see any 19-18 games. Now, you've chosen the Red Sox to win the World Series the last couple of years, I believe. Are you sticking with that prediction this time?
Well, I picked them at the beginning of this season, and I picked them at the beginning of this postseason. Not like I didn't want to change that about 10 days ago or a week ago. Jeez. But I'm going to stick with it just because I think something really special is going on here. I kind of figured that all along when Curt Schilling joined the team, that this team has the talent to do it. But then after watching the Red Sox come back and win with Mariano Rivera on the mound twice at Fenway Park, and he couldn't put him away, to go into Yankee Stadium and win the final two games there, including Game 7 on Mickey Mantle's birthday, to have two plays reversed by an umpire's call, which of course were the right calls, in Yankee Stadium, I said right then, this team is destined to win, so I'm going to stick with that.
Tim Kirkton covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you again.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
The St. Louis Cardinals won an exciting seven-game series to defeat the Houston Astros, earning their 16th trip to the World Series and the team's third Fall Classic matchup with the Boston Red Sox. Ron Schachter recently visited St. Louis, and he has this report from that relatively quiet yet quintessential baseball town.
St. Louis Post-Dispatch deputy sports editor Roger Hensley can give you plenty of reasons why the national pastime has become the local obsession.
Championships. It's all about championships. And the Cardinals have 9 of them. I believe that's second only to the Yankees. They've been here forever.
Indeed, the Cardinals have been in business since 1882. So it should come as no surprise that local interest in the 2004 postseason exceeded interest in the presidential debate held in the city 2 weeks ago. Candidates Bush and Kerry were treated like any other visiting team. In the upscale Union Station Mall, about 10 blocks from Busch Stadium, a sign in front of the Route 66 brewery says, "Support the Cards, drink red ale." A gallery across the way features nothing but numbered photographs of baseball art. A United States flag with lines of baseball serving as stripes, a well-worn baseball mitt cradling a well-used ball. And there's the official Cardinals Clubhouse store, where you'll find no end of red and white clothing and paraphernalia.
Up here are the jerseys. That's a replica home jersey.
It hasn't hurt that the Cardinals won 105 games in claiming the NL Central crown and raised hopes for their first world championship since 1982. They feature a modern-day murderer's row of Albert Pujols, Scott Rolen, and Jim Edmonds, who combined for 358 RBIs during the regular season, and along with recent acquisition Larry Walker, have powered the Cardinals in the playoffs. But, adds the Post-Dispatch's Hensley, the Cardinals have built a winning team more quietly and efficiently than the higher-profile Yankees and Red Sox.
If there's a bidding war going on for a huge player that's out there, you don't hear the Cardinals' names even getting involved in that. So, generally speaking, they're not going to go out and just overpay to get this big name to come here.
Attendance at home games, meanwhile, has averaged more than 3 million over the past 7 seasons. Most observers, Hensley included, say that those fans are savvy customers.
They recognize a good play, they recognize hustle, and they will cheer that for either team that's out there. These people know the team. They're likely to be able to tell you the batting order of the, from 1 through 8. It's a very educated fan base.
At Mike Shannon's restaurant, owned by the former Cardinals outfielder and veteran of two world championship teams in the 1960s, longtime fan Pam Moran says she's collected Cardinal memories since she was a kid.
I went to Lou Brock's 500 stolen base. The game stopped. They brought out a new car, Corvette, I believe, Stingray, and a boat, and gave them to him as gifts. That was a day to remember.
Bob Krizek, a communications professor at the University of St. Louis, has taken a sociological look at fans in their ballparks around the country. In contrast to the long-suffering Red Sox nation and the in-your-face Yankee fans, Krizek says that the Cardinals fans are better known for their sense of community.
It really is a small town, although it's a good-sized city, which translates really well into a fan base for baseball that I think might be one of the reasons why there's such a strong support for the Cardinals in this town.
The Cardinals will have to wait until Tuesday to put their hometown advantages to the test when they return from Boston for Game 3 of the World Series. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in St. Louis.
There they go, and we want the world to know. Give a cheer, shout it clear, let them know that we're all here. That bunch of Cardinals and Mr. Hornsby, we're mighty proud of you.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The recent departure of the Expos from Montreal has made everything associated with the franchise collectible, even the last hot dog sold at Olympic Stadium. Energy 102.3, a Quebec radio station, came into possession of the final hot dog sold at the last game, and this week the station auctioned off the wiener for $2,605 to Cirque du Soleil. Proceeds to go to a local children's charity. The folks at Energy 102.3 had a mold made of the comestible and built a trophy around it. But station manager Jean Martin said the auction winner would also get the real hot dog, which is preserved in a jar and accompanied by a certificate of authenticity, should anybody challenge it as a fraudulent final prank. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, postseason predictions from the pitch rather than from the diamond. But first, if you're not one of the few lucky fans who attended League Championship Series games in person, you're one of a large number of spectators forced to watch them on Fox television. If you are one of the latter, you've been barraged with the usual loud and colorful exhortations to buy beer, trucks, and cell phones, but you've also heard analysis bordering on the surreal. Here to discuss Fox's playoff coverage is Steve Rushen, whose Air and Space column is featured in Sports Illustrated. Steve, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be back.
The television technology for presenting baseball gets more and more sophisticated, even as baseball remains pretty much the same fairly simple game. What technological innovations have you found especially useful or useless? And feel free to start with Scooter, the animated talking baseball, if you like.
Scooter, I'm glad that I finally know what a curveball curves and that a fastball is fast. And I presume these instructions are for me, since I'm imagine the 7-year-olds aren't awake at 12:45 a.m. when Scooter is explaining that a knuckleball waffles. But that's been helpful. And I also like the cameras. I forget what Fox's nickname is for them, but they're sort of in front of home plate, and Jorge Posada likes to cover them up with dirt, and it gives you the vantage point of actually watching a baseball game as if you're lying on your back between the pitcher's mound and home plate.
To what extent can we blame television rather than Major League Baseball or the players for the lengths of these games?
Well, somebody said to me yesterday that there's so much at stake when the Red Sox are playing the Yankees in terms of television revenue, hotels, restaurants, and all that they have to stretch it to 7 games. And I thought, how does television arrange for Derek Jeter to have a little flare single over, you know, the first baseman to bring in a couple of runs? So I think television certainly makes the games longer, but whether they're extending the series is, I think, a kind of a wild-eyed conspiracy theory.
That's why I embrace it.
Yes, exactly, of course. But, you know, some of the things that happen in these games are so weird that even it may even be on the powers of Fox to orchestrate that kind of reality television.
The announcers have come in for some criticism. Let's start with Tim McCarver, who maintained on Tuesday night that when the Yankees got a man on base in the ninth inning via a walk, that was as good as a home run. What was he thinking?
You know, I would hate to have to crawl inside that head, but I had the same reaction that, are they now awarding runs for a walk? And if the next batter, Bernie Williams, hits into a double play, will Matsui not be called out?
Yeah, because the Yankees get a run for that double play.
Yeah, he is sort of psychically homered. I don't know if it's Tim McCarver's southern cadence. He's from Memphis. Somebody had mentioned how Tim McCarver mentioned early in the series that Derek Jeter has the calmest eyes he has ever seen on a baseball field. I always thought the eyes of Fred Bird, the Cardinal mascot, which I think are polyurethane, were the most placid I've ever seen in a ballpark. But he may have been right about Jeter. But he's starting to remind me of Dan Rather on election night in 2000 when he was saying things like, you know, if a frog had pockets, he could pack a gun and things like that. Some of the Zen cones that he's delivering, you know, they are food for thought, particularly at 1 in the morning when you're sort of half delirious in the first place.
Are the announcers constantly being told through earpieces to keep talking, even when they have nothing to say and the pictures are doing a pretty good job of conveying the game?
Well, I don't know. I know there has been some of that. I was actually at Fenway Park for the middle three games of the series, and I saw a gentleman in the right field bleachers not far from where I was who was holding a sign that said, attending the Red Sox game in person, and then he had a row of dollar signs underneath that, not having to listen to Joe Buck, priceless. So I'm maybe particularly in Boston, there may be some sentiment that they're talking too much, particularly when the Red Sox were taking heavy beatings and the things they were saying weren't too charitable. But there is a lot of yakking, that's for sure.
Let's try to achieve some balance here, Steve. Have any of the guys presenting the games from Boston, New York, Houston, or St. Louis impressed you with their ability to convey games with style and with grace?
Well, I'm not sure that you're looking at the right network for style and grace. If you keep looking at the commercial breaks when they're presenting, promoting My Big Fat Obnoxious Boss and The Rebel Billionaire starring Richard Branson, whose tagline seems to be, bring clean underwear. Scooter may be the most dignified thing on the Fox network these nights. And I think you alluded earlier to a certain truck manufacturer whose commercials kind of actually scare me when they come on. Their tagline is "Hit it," and then there's a big drum, and it kind of blows you out of your chair when you're dozing in the 12th inning of a game.
Yeah, that and the poor guy in the swimming pool when the car comes flying at him. I still haven't quite figured out what that's an ad for, but it's alarming every time it happens.
And then there's a you can see those ads to be continued if you go to some website that they present, and I wonder how many people are actually leaving a tie American League playoff game to see what happens to the guy in the swimming pool.
Steve Rushen's column, Air and Space, is featured in Sports Illustrated. Steve, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
There is a man in a shiny suit. He's saying, get them off the streets and into the school. But he knows what he does. He's got a middle-aged spread. And he could never understand what's going on in my head. I'm going to get him tonight. I'll teach him a lesson, all right. I'm going to set my telecaster to the television screen. Because I don't like what's going down.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org.
I got the right, I got the ticket and the buck stops here.
The Major League Soccer postseason is underway. Today, Columbus faces New England, and D.C. United will take on New York, New Jersey. Tomorrow, Kansas City plays San Jose. Here to preview the ninth annual MLS playoffs is soccer analyst Seamus Mallon. Seamus, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The presence of Freddy Adu increased attendance at D.C. United games this season, both at home and away. He's been hurt, but will his skills help D.C. United reestablish the team as a presence deep into the postseason?
I think he's a more mature player. That sounds ludicrous to say because he's
15 now rather than 14, right?
But he has grown in the game quite a bit despite the injuries. And in the recent matches, he was, I think, a much better player as a team player and didn't feel kind of the pressure to do it all on his own. So I think that will make a difference. But also keep in mind that Christian Gomez has had a fantastic play year for D.C. United, and also Jaime Moreno, who a lot of players around the league think is a candidate for MVP.
And who is actually considerably older than 15.
Yes, yeah, right, like about twice as much.
Right. The New England Revolution qualified for the playoffs with a win in their last regular season game. Does the fact that the Revs made the playoffs with an 8-13-9 record make making the playoffs a somewhat suspect achievement, and does it argue for a different system?
I think it does, yes. No offense intended to the Revs, who have had all kinds of misfortune this year. They have some terrific players. Noonan is leading the league in goals scored and so forth, and Dempsey is a candidate for Rookie of the Year. So they've got the talent, but their injury list was horrible. But the point is that too many teams make the playoffs. It is ludicrous, totally ludicrous for a 10-team league to be playing all season long to eliminate two sides. So hopefully they'll get around to getting a bit more mature about that when the league expands next year and adds two more teams.
What's your projection as far as the Eastern Conference Finals are concerned?
Well, it's hard to bet against Columbus, I think, because they have got the formula that tends to work in playoffs, namely a very strong defensive side. I mean, this is a team that lost only five matches all season. Now, mind you, they had a lot of ties. The Wags were calling them not the Columbus Crew, but the Columbus Drew.
Soccer humor.
Yeah, soccer humor. And they have some, I mean, they've got very good defensive. Robin Fraser's had a terrific year for them. Simon Elliott, Chad Marshall have come in, and they've been great at the back. Tony Senna, I mean, they're really tough to beat. Where they may have some difficulty is in getting the goals they need. Edson Buttle and Kyle Martino are now the strikers for them, and that certainly helps. But I would think they are going to be severely pressed by D.C. United. I think there might be an upset by the time we get to the finals of the East, and it could be that D.C. United will push the Crew out of the picture. How's that for sticking my neck out there?
The limb is creaking that you're out on the end of. In the Western Conference, 2000 MLS champion Kansas City Wizards will take on the 2001 and 2003 champion San Jose Earthquakes. Which team do we see parlaying its playoff experience into a trip to the finals in that conference?
Well, here again, Kansas City have perfected the art of defending, which takes you long and deep into the playoffs, even though it's not that many games here in the MLS setup. But surely San Jose can't be as poor a team as their season-long record has shown. I mean, I think the feeling is that having just made the playoffs, like the Revs, frankly, on the last day, they are a team that is potentially ready to explode if they can just sort out a few defensive problems. Kansas City, on the other hand, are incredibly difficult to break down. But I think as a lover of the beautiful game, my heart here says San Jose, and there's a piece of my head that is saying Kansas City, but I'm trying to repress it.
And San Jose is about to become the something else Earthquakes, or do they get to stay the San Jose Earthquakes? Despite all these previous championships, the future of this franchise is somewhat cloudy.
Yeah, I think it is cloudy. The future locale of the team is very, very dicey at the moment, and that can't help but have had an adverse effect on some of the team psyche at the moment. I mean, even though Alexi Lalas is toiling away in the front office there and trying to make a go of it with all his inborn and expressed enthusiasm, nonetheless, it's a sad situation where a team that is so good and has such a good record struggles to get people to come and sit in the stadium and watch them. And I think they will have as inspiration, let's show you kind of mentality in the playoffs.
Major League Soccer has tinkered with playoff formats, schedules, all-star game formats, pretty much anything that could be tinkered with. What has the league done correctly this year, in your opinion, and what does it still need to work on?
Long pause. I think they are progressing in what my philosophy is of leave the game alone. I have to keep reminding people that we in the United States are the stewards of the world's game. We are not the reinventors of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I get furious with college coaches who insist on tampering with rules and substitution and all this nonsense. Step back, play the game the way it's played all over the world successfully, and the way our national team needs to continue to have it played so they're going to be continuing to progress. So I think in that sense, MLS has done well to leave things alone. I like the playoff format of two matches, total goals, to the winner advancing who scores the most goals over two games. And also, I would perhaps fault them a little bit, and this may seem very un-American, really, not to have suspended play on some of the weekends when the United States had to play World Cup qualifiers, because the future of this game really is inexorably tied to the success of the United States national team, and they need to get all the support. And the notion that, you know, you pull away players and then those teams become weakened on the weekend is ridiculous. The rest of the world suspends play. We should, too.
There will be two new Major League Soccer teams next year, one notable for its ties to Mexico, and the other, I think, for its curious choice of name. Can you talk a little bit about Real Salt Lake?
Oh, please. Yeah. Unreal, as we say.
Unreal, yes.
I'm just totally perplexed. I mean, it is a noble intent to bring the international aspect of the game into a new venue, namely in Salt Lake City, by calling it Real, R-E-capital-A-L, so that everybody out there
pronounces it correctly.
Rockies will pronounce it correctly. But what is royal, to translate the word from Spanish, about Salt Lake? What is royal about America, to be honest?
Unless Franco has spoken from the grave and said that it's his favorite team, I don't understand the connection very well.
It really is a bit of a joke, I'm sorry to say, because I don't like to joke about MLS. I like to take everything they do seriously. But they really should have reconsidered that name, just as they did, by the way. If you recall, Kansas City in the early days was called, of all things, the Wiz. Right.
Seamus Mellon is a soccer analyst who joins us from time to time. Thank you, Seamus.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. A winning baseball team, a baseball team good enough to make it to the World Series, in this case a team that seems to be good enough to win the World Series for the first time since 1918, this can provoke some extraordinarily nutty behavior. I give you, for example, just one of the anthems sent into Only a Game this week, even before the Red Sox beat the Yankees in Game 7 of the American League Championship Series.
A curse is a curse, of course, of course. And no one reverses a curse, of course. That is, of course, unless the curse is the curse of Mr. Ruth. A curse so perverse will not disperse, especially when backed by the boss's purse. But he can't deter the approaching hearse for the curse of Mr. Ruth.
Thank you very much. I think that will suffice. We also received a song that somebody's supposed to sing to the tune of If I Were a Rich Man and several other similarly inspired works. The triumph, even the anticipation of the triumph of a team, can be great fun. Silly, but no less great for that. A winning team can charge the air of a city, even a region. It can make instant baseball fans of folks who, until those charged days, didn't know a knuckleball from a knuckle sandwich. The team can unite people, and though certainly the coalition is fragile and temporary, it's no less intoxicating for that. But the excitement inspired by a team headed for the World Series, or by a team that has won the Super Bowl, or the NBA championship for that matter, can also generate stupidity and madness. After the Red Sox beat the Yankees in New York on Wednesday night, an estimated 80,000 people spilled out into the streets around Fenway Park in Boston. Most of them were euphoric, but enough of them were determined to bang on cars, toss bottles, set fires, and otherwise endanger themselves and others, so that the police responded as they might have to any other riot. One of the officers began shooting pepper spray-filled pellets into the crowd. One of those pellets struck a 21-year-old college student in the eye and killed her. A day later, Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling, speaking on a Boston radio station, stated the obvious when he said that no victory is worth such a tragedy. He urged fans in Boston to, quote, grow up in the next several days. We can hope that anyone who might be inclined to celebrate a win or mourn a loss, not by making up a silly song, but by destroying property or attacking the police and creating a situation dangerous and even potentially fatal for whatever innocent fans might have come along for the ride, were listening to Kurt Schilling's appeal. We can hope that, because the appeal is sensible, or perhaps because it was made by a ballplayer fans respect, Mr. Schilling's words will have some impact. We can all hope for that.
So the curse is inert and will soon be first. No power remains to avert or hurt. We have burst the curse. My verse enters the curse of Mr. Ruth.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Hong Kong fishermen race dragons. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The World Series begins tonight with the Cardinals facing the Boston Red Sox in Fenway Park. Now that the hyperbole has died down a little bit, would you care to put the Red Sox ALCS comeback against the Yankees into the proper perspective?
This was a glorious win in the semifinals.
I asked for perspective, and got it.
You got to remember that historically, the St. Louis Cardinals have more to do with the Red Sox long history of futility than the New York Yankees do.
At least in the World Series.
Half of the World Series that they've been in since 1918, they have fallen to the St. Louis Cardinals, once as favorites and once as underdogs. Bob Gibson's not pitching this time around, is he?
Not so far as I know, and neither is Jim Lonborg. So in the aftermath of Boston's victory over the Yankees, Charlie, a college student died after she was hit in the eye with a pepper spray ball shot by a Boston police officer. Is there any way to handle crowds of 80,000 people more effectively?
As it happens, I was in Kenmore Square. A friend of mine was doing a reading at a bookstore in Kenmore Square at about 7:30 at night, the night of the game, before the game started. There was already a police presence. There were already fire trucks. Things seemed to be well under control in preparation. How this completely surged out of control, we'll have to wait for the various investigations to come. But I do wish somebody would stop referring to something to kill somebody as non-lethal ammunition, because it pretty plainly isn't.
In the series itself, the Cardinals, led by the brainy Dr. Brain Man, counselor at law, will try to send the self-proclaimed idiots to yet another ignominious World Series defeat. Is this a series in which we see an imbalance of gray matter and brain power?
Well, we see an imbalance of right and left arms is what we see. The Houston would have been a much more pitching-heavy team for the Red Sox to face. The St. Louis starting pitching is shaky. Their middle relief is awful. And they may have burned their closer out against Houston, whereas, you know, the Boston pitchers, while certainly not rested, are better pitchers than anything the Cardinals can throw up, rested or not.
This leads me to think that your prediction would find Boston winning in 6-7?
I'll say 7, because it's always 7 between these two teams.
On Thursday, the Court of Arbitration for Sport ruled that Paul Hamm will get to keep his gold medal, the one he earned in the men's all-round gymnastics competition in Athens. Despite this legal victory, will Hamm have to accommodate the dreaded asterisk for the rest of his days?
Oh, probably not, because people will stop caring about Paul Hamm in about 6 weeks. He had a little surge the other day when he got to keep his medal. But for people like Paul Hamm, it's a real shame that Love Boat's not still on the air.
Well, I'm wondering if the outcome in the Paul Hamm matter will dissuade the Russian Olympic Committee from following through with its appeal with the CAS to strip Tyler Hamilton of his Olympic gold.
Boy, it's been a busy week at the Court of Arbitration for Sport, huh? I mean, those guys have been kept away from the donut table for far too long. The Russian Olympic Committee insists on the disqualification of Hamilton, says their statement. You know, the Tyler Hamilton doping situation is far cloudier and more full of authentic athletic gibberish than the Paul Hamm situation is. I don't think the Russians will win their case either.
Greek journalist Philippos Syrigos was stabbed and beaten by motorcycle attackers in Athens on Monday. He's a key witness in the investigation of the two Greek sprinters who allegedly faked a motorcycle accident in order to avoid drug tests during the summer games. It's apparently dangerous to write about corruption, particularly in Greece, even now.
It's not an easy thing to be a Greek sports writer, I'll tell you that. I didn't realize that he had been sued for libel by Gianna Angelopoulos, the head of the Athens Games, and her husband. Apparently he's been investigating whether or not there was some money changing under the table regarding some sponsorship programs there. And I know, Bill, you, as I am, is shocked.
Shocked
to learn that there might be corruption involved with the Olympics.
On Sunday, Annika Sörenstam topped $2 million in earnings for the fourth straight year. No other female golfer has ever topped $2 million in any season. Sörenstam, destined to become, I guess rather quietly, the most dominant athlete of all time?
She's going to be reckoned to be the greatest woman golfer of all time by a factor of about 12 by the time she's done. Sunday at the Samsung World Championship, she was four strokes back in the back nine and came back and won.
Mm-hmm.
She's just stronger and better and cooler than every other woman on the tour until Michelle Wee grows up. By that point, Annika will be in her golfing dotage, but that will be the only matchup probably left on the tour at that point.
Perhaps time to start saying Tiger Woods used to be the Annika Sörenstam of men's golf.
Tiger Woods can only aspire to be the Annika Sörenstam of men's golf.
There will be at least one less undefeated National Football League team after Sunday's game between the 5-0 New York Jets and the 5-0 New England Patriots. The Jets are apparently trying to model themselves after their arch nemesis. Why don't they just hire Bill Belichick?
Well, they tried that, remember? And he didn't want the job. There will be one undefeated team left after this weekend, and it will be the New England Patriots. The Jets are half a football team at best. They're undefeated by default, really. The American Football Conference is pretty much a landfill, and the AFC East is the worst part of the landfill. New England will win fairly easily, and New England, you know, may well get to 7 or 8-0.
Speaking of undefeated teams and landfills, a look at the standings in the National Football League this week suggests to me, anyway, that the league may be a little more top-heavy than the parity czar might prefer. What's in the offing here?
Well, there are going to be times, because one of the products of the enforced parity and the rigged system of the National Football League that everybody is so enamored of is the fact that sooner or later you get a league full of really mediocre and bad teams. This will give you teams, you know, like Pittsburgh or Atlanta, or God help us, the New York Giants, who are 4-1 and are really pretty bad football teams. But as somebody once said about the four presidents, preceding Abraham Lincoln, if you think those guys are bad, you got to look at the guys they beat, which is pretty much the same thing you could say about the NFL. There are really bad teams and mediocre teams, and the mediocre teams are beating the hell out of the really bad teams now.
Finally, Charlie, a Belgian soccer team recently conceded 58 goals in two games and 139 in the first eight matches they played this season. And people complain that the problem in soccer is not enough scoring.
That's a goal every 3 minutes and 6 seconds. I do love the spokesman for the club, though, who certainly has a future in the National Football League, if he ever comes across the pond, said they really love football and all the other teams credit them for their spirit. This credit can be fairly well summarized by the phrase...
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and fires us up each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On the eve of the final game of the American League Championship Series, Alan Myers, a Boston fan, was already preparing for disappointment further along the line. On Wednesday, he emailed Only a Game as follows. Just in case the Sox win Game 7 and go on to lose the World Series, I maintain that beating the Yankees trumps all that. Who remembers that after Bobby Thompson shot heard round the world that won the 1951 pennant for the Giants, they went on to lose the series to the Yanks? Yogi Berra might say its immortality still lives forever. Last week I spoke with Charlie Pierce about, among other things, the characterization of the plastic Lance Armstrong Livestrong bracelets as jewelry that some athletes were forbidden to wear during competition. Charlie thought it was a stretch to call the plastic bands jewelry, since he felt most women receiving them wouldn't be inclined to do so. Gretchen Andrus, who hears the show on New Hampshire Public Radio, wrote, I am a high school cross-country runner who wouldn't dream of running without my Lance bracelet. It seems New Hampshire has made an exception for them. My boyfriend gave it to me, and it is by far my favorite piece of jewelry. Another response to my conversation with Charlie last week came from Peter Anderson, who listens to the program by visiting onlyagame.org. Five words to describe Bill Littlefield and Charlie Pierce, he wrote. Very intelligent, but too glib. I wonder whom Mr. Anderson thinks is the intelligent one. From Geneva, New York, Gary and Sherilyn Shequin emailed to say, kudos to you and your show for the most delightful 60 minutes on public radio. Especially playful were the stories on the pilgrims donning red socks and the ballad of the whiskey robber. And do you know how lucky you are to have the most creative music writers for your program? The way they either find or specially write a piece of music to fit the story is amazing. Keep them, and if you can, give them a raise. The music writers appreciate that thought. Almost all of the songs are chosen by senior producer Gary Wallach, who writes music to fit the show only when absolutely necessary. He swears it. You can send us your comments or questions by writing Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Dragon boat racing, a 2,500-year-old Chinese event, is now an international sport, and it's reputed to be the fastest-growing water sport in the world. Paddlers cut through the water in long, narrow wooden boats decorated with ferocious heads and tails. This weekend, almost 2,000 paddlers from around the globe are competing in Shanghai for the World Championship. Earlier this year, Judith Ritter went to Hong Kong to witness the sport, and she has our report.
Here in Chaiwan, Hong Kong, on this weathered fishing boat, the deck is littered with salty nets and plastic buckets. Raymond Wong and his fellow fishermen prepare to do what their families have done for generations, race dragon boats.
My name is Raymond Wong here. My family is a very typical fishing family. So I start paddling since I was 15, 16 years old while I'm still studying. So now I'm 40-something, then I've been paddling for 30 years already. My grandfather's team is very strong because we won every year. It's been three generations already. But some guys, some club, they have maybe six or seven generations, over 100 years history in paddling.
For centuries, dragon boat racing only happened once a year during a five-day festival. In the old days, it was a sport for fishermen only and full of sacred ritual and prayers, including chanting and a ceremony involving chicken blood. Today, no chicken blood is shed, but chickens are on board for luck and as a reminder of ancient traditions. Fishermen climb down from their fishing junks into their 100-foot-long boats. The smell of incense wafts across the harbor. Dozens of elaborately painted boats with huge dragon heads bob in the waves. The surface of the water is littered with play money, toy dollars scattered for good luck. These 2-ton boats are driven by up to 50 paddlers who sprint the 500 meters as onboard drummers establish the paddling cadence. That paddling is sometimes as fast as 100 strokes per minute. In the stern, steersmen keep the boats on course for the 2 or 2.5 minute powerful surge to the finish line. Raymond Wong's team wins this one. They're ecstatic as they pile back onto their fishing boat. Dragon boat racing has undergone a modern transformation. What was once a 4th-century spiritual ceremony is now a rare social opportunity for busy 21st-century fishermen. Again, Raymond Wong.
we grew up together. Maybe we moved separately. We scatter everywhere. But when we play drum boat, then we get back together. It's a time for us to reunion, to see our old friends. It's a good chance to meet the old guys because some go getting out fishing. They normally stay in China for maybe 1 or 2 months. Boat festival is a chance for them to get back to Hong Kong, to stay together, just a family reunion. Yeah.
And there have been other changes. In the past, neither foreigners nor women were allowed in dragon boat racing.
First place, the Lynx Lama ladies. In the second place, the Royal Lynx women. In third place, Mezami, Peddlers Babes. In fourth place, the AWA Blazing Ladles.
According to the International Federation of Dragon Boating, there are over 50 million paddlers, men and women around the globe. These teams from North America, Europe, and Australia compete against each other and against the fishermen, and they're passionate about the sport.
Well done, lobster man.
These relative newcomers say this sport is more demanding than kayak, canoe, or crew.
The hardest thing to teach people how to do in dragon boating is technique.
Canadian Cordelia Chan teaches dragon boating to expat North Americans and Europeans in Hong Kong.
Because people go into the boat with an assumption of what they should be doing. For example, like a kayaking stroke or a rowing stroke. And although there are basic principles that are the same in dragon boating, it is different. And trying to get them to pick up those differences and to get it right is very, very difficult, especially if they're stubborn.
And for some, like Californian Sharon Tudela, dragon boating is more than a sport. The explosion of power created by a team in perfect harmony is, well, maybe transcendent.
When we're on the boat, we breathe the same rate. We pant at the same time. Our paddles hit the water at the same time. The motions are uniform, and you feel like you're a cell in this whole unit, which is really exciting.
This weekend, Team America is competing in the Dragon Boat World Championships in Shanghai. And rumor has it, dragon boat racing will be a demonstration sport at the Beijing Olympics in 2008. Most likely, minus the chicken. For Only a Game, I'm Judith Ritter in Hong Kong.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Bill Marks, Monica Brady-Meyeroff, and Glenn Alexander. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out our web feature on Dragon Boat Racing, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Red Sox outfielder Johnny Damon.
We're a bunch of growing up idiots.
Well, works for them at the ballpark. Works pretty well for us at Only a Game, too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.